Welcome to episode 1, season 2 of the American Dream Podcast. I am so excited to be back hosting this show, and I can't wait to share the career stories of so many underrepresented people across all of the United States and the globe. But before I do, I thought it might be helpful to give you a bit more background on who I am and my own story. I hope you enjoyed this recording from High Alpha's speaker series where I talk about my journey from a high schooler in Nicaragua to the co-founder of a unicorn company based in Boston, Massachusetts.
Okay, let's do it. Hi, everyone. I'm Scott Dorsey, partner at High Alpha. And on behalf of the entire team, welcome. We're thrilled to have you join us for this outstanding speaker series. I think you're in for a real treat. And I'm thrilled to introduce our guest, Elias Torres, founder and CTO of Drift, coming to us from Boston. Elias, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
Elias is an extraordinary entrepreneur, and we'll hear about his founding of Drift and his entrepreneurial journey. And I'm not sure I've met a founder, I think, that just has just more fire, grit, determination, intensity, all those amazing qualities that we need as early stage entrepreneurs. And I know you're going to really enjoy meeting him today and kind of hearing his story. Elias, I think maybe to get started, I know you grew up in Nicaragua and came over to the United States to go to high school and college. And, you know, why don't we start there? If you would, maybe share some of your life story and your journey, and then we'll kind of dig into individual experiences.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think all that stuff is kind of like a blur to me, right? I mean, I think I've always been just fumbling my way through this stuff in the darkness. I didn't know what universities to apply. I was looking for the thing that had the least friction. It was the college, you know, in Tampa, where I live with my mother, and I didn't want to, you know, I was thinking, why would I pay for a room and board, you know, when I can stay with her? And because we had to help each other out. And so I was looking for the simplest things that could help me, could get the job done. I followed a friend because I didn't speak much English. And so I started doing accounting by mistake, you know, and then I switched to information systems because I thought computer science was too hard. And so a lot of people would be like, the classes are hard, you know, and so I went a little bit of the easy route, which I regret later because I had to go back to school. I later on ended up going back to, I went to Harvard for a computer science.
Wow.
Instead of getting an MBA, I decided I needed a master's in computer science because I kind of needed to know a little bit more about computers for what I wanted to accomplish. But college was busy. I worked the whole time and helped support my family and graduated and then moved to the Northeast by hustling and by going to job fairs and interviewing. So like I ended up getting a job at IBM in Northeast in New England. And that's kind of what moved me from Florida to the North. And first time seeing snow, first time seeing cold weather, but it was an exciting first job. IBM, actually, my first job at IBM, I built chatbots.
How timely is that?
Yeah, absolutely. That was, I don't know if you know, remember AOL Instant Messenger? And
oh, of course, of course.
So IBM had bought the company Ubique from out of Israel that built that. And they built this Lotus Same Time product that was a messaging product. And so we deployed that across the company and people were like, why are you chatting? This is wasting people's time. And the CEO wasn't happy, Lou Gerstner. And but the adoption went like wildfire. Everybody wanted to have instant messaging. And so we decided to build bots on top of that. And so that was like one of my first brand new employee, just graduated from college. And I was like, this is not that interesting.
I mean, what an amazing foundation, right? To build that kind of knowledge and experience with a big company. But while you were going through that IBM journey, did you feel like you were an entrepreneur inside, just kind of waiting to start something or create something, or, you know, kind of where's that entrepreneurial spirit and background come from?
Yeah, I had, when I joined IBM was 1999, 98, I graduated in 98. So I started January of 99. And I really did not know what entrepreneurial was in a way. And, but I did have my first opportunity, but I missed it, to join the internet, you know, boom, right, in 99. I had a lot of friends who were like, let's move to New York City, and like they were leaving IBM, we're going to start companies. look at the IPOs, look at the stuff. And I was kind of like, not sure. And so I almost did it, but it's a long story, but okay, quick. I got my car towed at the airport, picking up my wife, and I was connected on my laptop at the airport, trying to figure out what to do with the keyboard connected into the public phone. And I was on instant messaging with my vice president from IBM, and he said, I'll take care of you. And he sent a car. He got a hotel room for me to wait for my wife to come, that she was coming from Ecuador. And so he treated me so well that I said, I'm going to stay here. And it made a huge difference. And I was there for 10 years. And so I didn't know really I wanted to be an entrepreneur. What I knew is that I was frustrated at IBM because everybody moved so slow. Everybody had different agendas, 400,000 person company. And I wanted to get more done. You know, I'm impatient. I'm always rushing. I always want to get something quickly.
So what was your next step beyond IBM?
So at IBM, when I got sort of frustrated, I started putting myself out there. I started blogging. I started joining meetups and doing things like that. And then some people started to get to know me, and they were like, do you want to be a co-founder here? Do you want to join my startup? But I had this imposter syndrome, which, you know, I've carried for a long time, where like, oh, you've been working 10 years at IBM. You don't have the right skills for startups. And so I said, you know what, I'll prove it to you. How about if I work nights and weekends for you guys and then see if you like me? So I started doing that. And that really led to people saying, give them a vote of confidence. They're like, can you do this? But I wasn't quite sure which of these teams or companies to say yes to. It's a really hard problem, you know, that people have. How do you, picking a company as an employee is as hard as picking a company as an investor, right?
Oh, absolutely.
I kept saying no until I met David Cancel, who's my partner in crime. We've done so many companies together. And I met him, and that's when I felt comfortable. I was another Latino, and he made me feel safe, you know, and said, let's do it. Don't worry. Just leave IBM after 10 years and come and work at this small little company. And then a year later, that company failed. It was worse than that. I joined him August of 2008.
Oh, wow. How's that for timing?
Yeah. And so I joined him, and then an entire market crash, collapses, everything, great financial crisis. And I'm like, whoa, what did I do? I had three children at home. My wife is staying at home with kids. I have no savings. I have no safety net. I have no parents to go to. And I live in Lowell, Massachusetts. So it was super, super interesting time, but I just kept my head down and listened. That was the day I joined David at the startup. 10 person company.
Wow.
Like only like a million and a half raise. And we persevered for over a year, but then he failed.
Tell us more about David, you know, the partnership, how you two complement one another, and maybe if you don't mind, weave in a little advice to those founders on the line that are, you know, thinking about starting a company and kind of trying to decide whether to go it alone or bring on a co-founder and what to look for a co-founder.
Yeah. Co-founder. I don't know what advice to give. I don't like giving advice. I kind of like giving advice, but most people don't.
All right, well, just share your experience.
I'll tell you what I did, right? And what happened with David was that David was my senior, had way more experience than me. And so I in retrospect, I feel like I was the right choice. If you join someone that is equal with you in experience, you're not going to learn anything from that person. And so I was willing to sacrifice equity in return in exchange for experience. And therefore, he was senior to me, and he was the CEO, and I was the CTO. So I was the number two.
Okay.
I remember one time at Drift, we had raised 100 and something plus million dollars. I'm the co-founder, I'm the CTO. We show up at the building years later, right? And the security woman says to me, well, the day that we're moving in on Sunday, you're the number two, right? And I'm like, that's the worst thing you can tell the number two. You're like the number two. But anyways, I think that the idea was that's really the secret though, being number two and being comfortable with it, you know, for the period of the arrangement of the agreement. is that you got to be humble, and you have to understand what you're learning from it and not be trying to fight that off. Doesn't matter. You can also grow, and you can get coaching. You can grow whatever you want. You grow at whatever speed. Grow faster, grow better, grow slower. It doesn't matter, but not let that ego stop you from being a partner. And we've been a partner at four companies, right? For almost 15 years. And so it's like, you know, it's like, and it's been the best ride of my life, because I wouldn't be where I am today if it wasn't for his help.
That's remarkable. So first company didn't work out. How about the second one?
Second one, he goes, Elias, you want to start a company? And I'm like, yes, I get to be a founder, CTO, two people, we're equal. And we did that. And I went to a meetup, and I was telling everybody, oh, I'm a founder now, I'm a CTO. So the word got around, he gets a call, and then he calls me back and he goes, what are you doing? And I'm like, oh, I'm at a meetup. He goes, do you want to build a company or do you want to be at meetups? And I was like, I want to build a company. Okay, then get to work. And right. So that was the last conference I went in 15 years. You know what I mean? And say, I only went to conferences if we were organizing it for our companies, whether it would be HubSpot, Inbound, or that kind of stuff. But basically, we started that company in about a year and a half, crazy stuff. It's like we got to $1 million in revenue in 2009. We started in 2009. By 2011, so we were in the marketing space, really discovering, you know, email nurturing sequences, event-based messages that you're sent from your registration, from your database, and web analytics, you know. And so we were doing those things. And HubSpot took interest in us and bought the company in 2011 and brought 20 of us to help HubSpot grow. At that time, HubSpot was only about 200 people. About $30 million in revenue, and really had a lot of problems with building the product and scaling it and really managing so many apps. And in fact, we couldn't even send email at that time. And there was a big company out there called ExactTarget that could send a lot of email. So those are the kind of juggernauts that I had to go against, you know.
Tough competition out there.
Those indie people, don't mess with them.
Yeah, don't mess. That's right. We go fast.
Don't mess with indie, you go fast. Exactly.
At least I'd love to go back to the meetup, because I think it is kind of an interesting theme of, it's kind of easy to get caught up in the excitement of being a founder and all that comes with it. And you have to balance all the outside distraction with what like matters most, like build your team, build product, and find customers. And do you see that in other entrepreneurs and founders, that sometimes there can be the kind of tension or push-pull between all the outside activities versus like how to be a ruthless prioritizer?
Yeah, I mean, I think I have a hard definition that I learned with David, that if you're building a company, you shouldn't be doing anything else.
Yeah.
At most, the only thing that you could be doing is like, if you have kids or you have a family, right, you have a partner, like be there for them as much as you can. But I ain't going to guarantee you can be there for everything that you might want to. But that should be your only priority. And health, I worry about that later. And now I'm paying it. You know, I'm a little heavy. But the thing about it is I think that it should be the number one priority. For example, I was at a private social club on Sunday, and there was a guy that wants to start a company, and he was playing pool on a Sunday. And I tell you what went to my head to this day, right? It's like, I was going to give him as a joke, and I was like, you're starting a company? What are you doing here? You know, it's like, you really want to build something? You got to work, you know, as a founder, yeah. It doesn't stop. Rest, make sure you sleep, right? Sleep, I think, is number one. But other than that, it's like I had to work really hard to get here, and it's not, nobody was going to give it to me.
So true. I know you take a lot of pride in building teams. At least like I know one of your kind of mantras is like build team first, product second. You know, I'd love for you to talk a little more about just hiring, recruiting, you know, what your experience has been over time in building amazing teams.
I love hiring. I'm an extrovert. I like talking. I'm not normal. I'm not conventional. I'm really, I found out there's reviews of me is I'm too intense. You know, I challenged them. I came across as this or a cocky or the other. And it's like, I can't help it. Just people don't understand culturally where I come from, who I am, what I really like inside. But the way I am externally is the only way I can be. I'm not going to change it, right? And so what I tend to gravitate is I tend to hire people that connect with it. Okay. You don't connect with it, you're not going to want to say yes to me when I give you a job
offer, right, right.
How qualified you are. So I just love that because I tend to attract a very extroverted, fun, like for some of my engineering organizations, everybody says you have the most extroverted engineers that want to speak to customers, that want to talk about problems, that want to collaborate on things. So I tend to bring that. I might not bring the stereotypical more introvert, brainiac, you know, engineer. Over time, as my teams have grown, we tend to balance it out. And and I love when I can break through those personalities and make a connection because I understand them. I like to bring balance into the team because you have to have a diverse set of values and thinking in the team. But without the team, you cannot build anything. You can dream of whatever product you want, but to go fast and to create a culture that attracts great people, I'm not the only one. In fact, I'm not the best attractor of people. It's the people that I tend to hire first that then help me attract the rest, right?
Yeah, that's really good. That's really good. You mentioned earlier the challenge you had of being at IBM for a decade and people challenging you whether you could fit into an early stage company with a lot more ambiguity and speed and everything comes along with it. Have you successfully hired people from large companies and be able to help them adapt into a smaller environment?
I mean, I think like the key engineers that were at IBM with me came to do Performable, which then went to HubSpot, and they're still at HubSpot. You know what I mean? So it's possible. I think so, but it is much harder. I actually have tended to a pattern that I see with companies is that I tend to, I might be getting in trouble here, but I feel like people become less risk averse with time and experience and position. And always people are wishing and telling me like, oh, I wish I could have joined you when you were really early in your career. And then I go start something else like Drift, right? Or like HubSpot. And they're like, no, it's too risky. You know, it's like, I want something more stable. And so like, I think you want, but not a lot of people can repeat, right? And do it again and have that mindset. Their lives change, their interests, their needs, their wants. And so you kind of have to be open to hire people that are open to something new and something ambiguous, something that is not going to be a clear path or success, and neither success is guaranteed, right? So I think that's you got to gravitate to understand how to attract that group of people and don't be afraid of building new relationships, right?
Yeah, no, exactly. That's good. That's really good. And how do you assess technical talent? How do you assess the technical chops of a developer and engineer that's going to bring on board?
I can assess your ability really quickly. In about 5 minutes of a conversation, technically, I know whether I want to hire you or not. Okay. All I have to ask you is like, tell me about one project that they did and I can ask a few probing questions to go deeper and deeper to find out how deep did they go and how much did they build that themselves, right? And so from that aspect, there's so much I could tell you, right? It's like, how did you approach the problem? What kind of solve? Were you a perfectionist? Were you a generalist? Were you fast? Were you slow? Do you have a wealth of knowledge below the layers of the top of the stack all the way to the bottom of the stack? Who did you work with? What languages did you pick? Were you stuck? Were you prideful? Is it only this language to rule them all? Or have I tried multiple? So forth, right? So it's like you care about the customers. So you got to assess all of that stuff in 5 minutes, right? Of them.
that's quick. That's good.
Yeah. And then the rest of that is you spend time connecting and selling. And then you also spend time understanding more their mindset. What do they want? Their flexibility to work. Collaborative, right? And friendly. Do they like customers? And so forth. The technical part is quick.
That's so good. You just packed a lot of great wisdom into that answer. Congrats on Drift, by the way. I mean, what a extraordinary success you and the team have had at Drift. You know, perhaps take us to kind of that founding story, and then love to talk a little bit about finding product market fit.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, maybe I'll combine that too. So Drift was one of the, it was painful product market fit in starting a company. You know, it's like you go from HubSpot, you take HubSpot public, it's an amazing darling, and we decide to, just for kicks out of ignorance, David and I, like, let's start a company that becomes a $1 billion company from scratch ourselves. Like HubSpot, we kind of came when it was already 200 people.
Right.
And so there was this chip on my shoulder. Like, I want to do one mind. It's like this thing that you just don't know how hard that's going to be. And you just kind of like stupid founder, right? Like you think it's fun. Everybody thinks founder is fun. So I'm sorry, I'm talking to founders. Yes, founder journey is fun. But we went and did that and it was tough at the beginning. You know, you leave an amazing company with like 1,000 employees, just went public, so much infrastructure. We're just starting to have fun, right? I mean, it's like
going really well. Yeah.
Things are going really well. We fix all the problems. Right. And we're like, now we gotta go start from scratch. And so that was crazy. That was crazy. I don't know, everybody, Brian Halligan, Dharmesh, JD, they were like, Elias, what are you doing? Right. And so I was like, I wanna have my own. And so I did that and it was a really tough journey because we raised a lot of money and the expectations from everybody is like, what are you gonna do? What amazing thing you're going to build? And people wanna hear ideas of companies that are like just amazing. And guess what? Those almost never exist, right? It's like it only people start with the craziest ideas that turn into become some, most great ideas sound crazy,
right?
Or stupid, right? Or like that's ugly, or I don't want to do that, or you're ignorant. That's not a big space, and whatever, right? And so we were struggling, like of trying a lot of iteration and try many different ideas for 2 years.
Oh wow, wow!
We did a small team of 10 people. And we were just trying things out every few months, try something else until we felt that we had something. And I tell you, like, it never feels good. You kind of have to force some of these decisions and trust your gut and say, I'm going to go after this space, find a space that is big, find a place that has incumbents, because then it's easier. It just depends which strategy you want to follow, right?
Right.
If you're like, okay, that exists and it's crowded, then at least you know it's going to work. And people pay for it. So run, just do it. If you want to go try something that no one has ever done, there's no competitors, good luck. Because you're like, you know, exploring the seas and trying to find land, you know, and then find a new continent. And so it's really difficult. It's just I like to go into the exist route because it makes me feel warm that I know that if I work hard enough and I'm smart enough, whatever, I'm gonna find land.
I can win. No, that's really good. Cause yeah, creating a category is remarkably difficult and expensive and time consuming. And you're searching for budget that doesn't currently exist.
Yeah. But I mean, we did build a category, having said that. And so
yeah, but you went after kind of, you already knew there was a market insane. There.
There was a market, the market of messaging in app. We started in app, then we went to the outside and we stumbled our way into the moment where we felt when we had the pull from the customers, when we had product market fit, then we could start saying like, this feels slightly different. If we can carve it out and have our own niche out of here, right? It's like, maybe we can call that a category. And so we had, we're lucky had that opportunity, but we had great marketing with David to be able to say, well, how do we create one, right? And how can we sustain the drumbeat, right? To let everybody and educate. And that took a huge part of the investment in our efforts, right? And our energy at Drift.
No, that's so good. That's so good, Elias. You know, love to hear more about listening to customers, incorporating customer feedback into what you're building, searching for that market and that product market fit. And then that never ends. You know, to your point, once you get started, then you have traction and momentum. And, you know, I think the best companies and leadership teams are amazing at asking the right questions and listening, and then knowing how to go to the opportunity. You know, share, you know, if you would, maybe some of your learnings or best practices over the years in doing that, or some of your experiences at Drift.
I think that I was talking this morning to one of our engineers, and when he first showed up to Drift, like he was like, really just graduated from Northeastern, and then starts and he's like, what am I going to work on? And I'm like, okay, you're going to work on this problem. And the problem was a bug that a customer was highlighting, right? And it's like, and they're like trying to solve this problem, but they're not talking to the customer, right? And I'm like, and we were already kind of big when this person joined. And so he was afraid of like, I can't talk to the customer. I just graduated. And I'm like, you go call the customer. Right. And you go do it. And so we had this bi-weekly meetings where I would like check in with the team. And I'm like, so how did it go? And it's like, oh, amazing. I understand the problem. I know why they're upset. It's like this and that. And it was like, and I solved it right away. It was one line change and fixed it, deployed it. And wow. The customer is so happy, right? And it was like a big problem.
It's a breakthrough.
It's just that it's something that I learned. I mean, this is like when I was at Performable with David, that's the way I worked, right? I worked with customers that they would call me. I would be on the phone with them. The thing about it is that it's the reason why this is this way is because of my extrovertedness. You know, David is an introvert, but I'm old school, or I'm an extrovert that if I'm texting forever with you, I'd rather call you and we talk on the phone.
Right, right.
And so what happened was that when I had customers at Performable and we were a 20-person team, a customer was upset or something wasn't working, I would be like, what's your number? I'll call you. You're on Skype at that time. And we would just Skype and screen share. And I would be like, what's the problem? Show me the problem. And then I would edit the code. And then I would say reload. And the person would reload. And it would be like, so I kind of got addicted to this. Like,
right?
It's like, wow, they like it if I fix it, you know? And I was talking to them and I could to hear them. So I think that for people, you want to attract people that like that. Because if you really want to be customer driven, because that'll avoid this pitfall of like what I see the opposite, right? Let's learn the opposite. Maybe you guys are that, came from that, whatever, is like product managers pontificating about metrics and usage and how many seconds people spend on the page and what other page they went to. That's not talking to the customer. Asking for a survey. That's not talking to the customer. NPS score, that's not talking to the customer, right? Reviews, that's not talking to the customer. So I can keep going, right? So people understand that none of those things is talking to the customer. The only thing that is talking to the customer is talking to the customer like this, you and I. And so like when you talk to the customer, you're really gonna understand. There's a lot of things that go on in the relationships between humans and building trust, building a rapport, opening up, understanding their needs, their wants, and why are they going to ask you for help or not? Because most of the customers are just going to quit and churn your product. And so if somebody wants to talk to you, then you know you have the right person. And so like until you do that, you're doing it wrong.
Okay, Elise, that's huge. Like that's pure gold. That has to be one of your superpowers is a CTO who's extroverted, who loves to talk to customers. And I think that's unusual and unique. And I think it's unusual and unique to hire developers and engineers who have that same trait, that same characteristic, but that's what it's all about. And if you can close the gap between what the customer needs and feedback you're hearing and actually activating and implementing it into the code, into the product, you've got a pretty special formula there. I see much more of that happening in the product side of the org than the engineering side of the org. So let's just follow through on that a little further. How have you structured your teams around product and engineering historically? And then, maybe just talk about that. And then how do you infuse that culture into the engineering org of speaking to customers on a regular basis?
Well, I think that we like small teams. Okay. I get fought on this all the time, right? I like 3-person teams, 3 engineers, right? And keep it small. I don't like to have big teams. Reduce the noise, reduce the loss in communication, right? Maybe have 1 PM, 1 designer, 3 engineers, right? Something like that. Keep it really small, and you kind of have to own something top to bottom. If you split it horizontally, the lower you go, the less you're going to speak to the customer. So you're going to have only the engineers working on the surface are going to talk to customers. But if you split it vertically, right, and you the entire stack is owned by those, like every part of the app needs to be owned top to bottom, UI and backend, by that same team, then they have to go deal with the customers because
right,
then
right.
The bugs distribute more evenly, right?
Yes.
Than if you split it horizontally.
Let's talk generative AI. It's kind of, you know, turn the world upside down, infinite, you know, amount of possibilities and potential for what this next wave of technology looks like. You know, love to hear kind of how you're thinking about generative AI and then even some of your recent experiences.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's been something I've been noticing. It's been creeping up on me, right? It's like, we had bought an AI company that did bots. And so I got to see a lot of the precursor to this, right? We'd call, you know, before we had full-blown LLMs, right? And so smaller models that we would be building internally at Drift right. for our customers. So we had, you know, things like Word to Vector, we had BERT. So we had all these models and we were using them to do detection and to choose the next, you know, utterances in our conversations, but they just did not have enough knowledge. We were building very localized models for our customers. Which they're good. There's an advantage to them because they were not going to hallucinate and they're not going to say anything wrong. We knew
right.
what they would say. But this explosion that we have seen in the past year has been utterly incredible. And I think that this is one of the best times to be alive and maybe one of the last times we'll be alive. I don't know. Just kidding. But I think that I never seen technology more powerful than this. This is real. This is not hype. This is not crypto. Sorry if there's any crypto founders in here. It's all good. We're going to need digital currencies. Right. I'm all for that. But the reality is that I'm old enough, right? I missed the boat early on, right? Like I read about Xerox PARC and the first, you know, graphical user interfaces, the first, you know, the mice. And then the network and people were doing cameras in the 70s, right? They were doing video, you know, Ethernet, whatever. But we've been dreaming about this stuff in science fiction and it's real now. We have the ability for computers to do many things way better than humans can, which is to speak, to hear, to see, to draw, to paint, to write, right? And they're doing it better than us and they have way more knowledge and they can do it faster. And so now we are realizing the power of neural networks and that we can train them to do almost anything that is now, I think, out of the question where there's anything that we can do necessarily better as a single transactional task. And so we have to really realize how that's going to change the world. And it is a fantastic time to be alive and to see this progress. It could be scary. I think that I get to hear some of these voices firsthand. I've been to a couple events hosted by Sequoia in the Valley. I went to one where we had Sam Altman speak on what's happening, what takes his brain power day to day. There was the founder of NVIDIA, founder of CTO of Microsoft. It's fascinating to see this companies like Microsoft moving so fast. Usually that was only for startups, and you see them, the compute necessary, the technology, and they're building something that we just never thought it was possible, right? And so I think it's super exciting. Lots of stuff going on in the space. I went last week and I was Sequoia has an event called Basecamp for portfolio companies. Elon Musk was speaking, Greg Bachman, CTO, president of OpenAI. And you get to hear what the people at that level are thinking and the problems. And it's just so inspirational, right? Talking about how do we bring China into these discussions with the US? How do we create safety around AI? How do we democratize it? What happens with open source? How fast is open source coming behind these closed models, right? Should we be more open in research? Are we going to be closed? And so really understanding and trying to find, like every other founder, like what's in there left for us to build, right?
Where's the opportunity?
Where's the opportunity? But the opportunity is everywhere.
Everywhere.
If you're worried before, like, well, that company exists and that company exists, every single place, you gotta imagine it's completely open for disruption, right? And so what a great time to be alive.
Phenomenal. Elias, as you kind of brainstorm on generative AI use cases and solving business problems, you know, how much head time are you spending on like kind of application layer, you know, and thinking about how can I apply generative AI to solving business problems at the application layer versus going down into the LLMs and the data and tool side?
You know, I'm not an LLM guy, so like I definitely am not going to spend any time there. It'd be a waste of time. But I think that where I like to spend my time is more on the application, but more above that to the customer too. It's to like, I'm doing application enough to know how it works and do it myself. And you know, what is the things that are happening right now, right? Is you got to know how to use OpenAI APIs. You got to understand what embeddings are. You got to understand what prompt engineering is. You have to understand how to construct these prompts, how to train data, how to create data sets for this stuff, right? Or what similarity searches that you can do in this system. This is all new technology that I didn't have access before. So I'm getting to learn all of that. But at the same time, it's like, no, what is it that the customer needs, right? What do they need help with? And that's where you should also spend the time. There's a lot of concerns about, yeah, if we build the thin layer on top of OpenAI, what kind of companies can we build? Is it defensible? Is there a moat? But let me tell you that we never have moats. There are no moats. There's no such thing as moats. It's called run as fast as you can possibly can, you know, and build for the customer, and we'll see what's going to happen, right? But every day, this LLM world is changing. Like I heard, like, did you read the paper about that is leaked from Google that says OpenAI has no moat, and yes, they did it. You know what I mean? It's like, no, they don't have a moat. You know, with the open source, we're going to have specialized models that run in computers that are going to be powerful for a specific task, and we might not need the big ones. So it's crazy.
Unbelievable. I know. I started ExactTarget in 2001, you know, just as the internet was coming of age, you know, and just explosion of ideas and new business opportunities and an infinite number of ways in which the internet was going to transform our life and transform business. Feels like we're right back at that place with generative AI, which is incredibly energizing.
Yeah, we're right back at there. And I'll tell all the founders here, like everybody always says, at least I used to say, oh my God, I missed the boat. Why wasn't I in Silicon Valley? And why did I go to college in Silicon Valley, right? It's like, why didn't I start a company in 99 when Bezos was starting a company? Imagine I could have been Bezos. You know, how much better the world would have been. Oh, I missed that boat. And then the mobile phone comes out, the iPhone. I didn't build an iPhone app. I didn't become, you know, a multi-billionaire by building a flashlight app, you know? And so like other people did. And so I kept missing the boat, but I've kind of like caught up this technology wave, I think, around the cloud. And I was like, okay, finally, I got onto something with Performable, with HubSpot, with Drift. And if you're there wondering if you started a company right now and you're worried that you lost the valuations from last year or from 2020, 21, and you're like, oh my God, those are the good old days. This is the best time to start a company. Like everybody that is in a company is wishing they could be starting a company like you, where you can create an AI native, AI first company and solve the next set of problems, because you're early, everybody else is going to be late to the party, right? And so you have a great opportunity, enjoy it, you know, have fun.
Awesome.
I'm jealous. Yeah.
I love it. That's like the perfect note to end on. Thank you so much for this conversation. It's been so inspiring for me. I'm sure it has been for the entire High Alpha community. And congrats on all your success, and look forward to staying in close touch and, you know, figuring out what this next horizon looks like for all of us.
Absolutely. It's going to be good. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the American Dream Podcast. Make sure to subscribe so you never miss a new episode. And share the episode with your friends. Our work isn't done until everyone has equal access to their dreams.